Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and again, I'm joined by Blue Frontier's Natasha Benjamin. So, hi, Natasha.
Hi, David. It was great hanging out at the Peter Benchley Awards a few weeks ago at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, and good to talk again now.
Yes, that was a whole inspiring evening, and thanks in large part to the Aquarium Conservation Partnership that has helped revive the awards. And today we're happy to have as our guest Kim McIntyre, the executive director of the partnership. It's a coalition of 35 aquariums working together to increase their collective impact. The partnership's active in educating tens of millions of aquarium visitors and also policymakers around issues ranging from climate change to plastic pollution to, well, we'll get into that. But before we do, let's do some blue news you can use.
Well, in addition to downsizing NOAA and gutting habitat protections for endangered species, in April, our president, Donald Trump, issued one of his executive orders calling for deep sea mining in both federal and international waters. For those of you who don't know what deep sea mining involves, it's using these massive underwater tractors to scrape the seafloor of these potato-sized nodules that contain valuable minerals like nickel and cobalt and manganese. And these nodules can actually be up to 15 million years old. But deep sea mining companies are claiming that we need these minerals for batteries, for electric vehicles, and other technologies. David, I just read your Blue Frontier Substack on this. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening?
Sure. In May, the Department of Interior began moving forward on a lease application for mining of waters off American Samoa. So new U.S. ocean policy under Trump seems to be like move fast and break things. I did my first article on deep sea mining back in 1977 because, you know, bad ideas that promise quick returns seem to never get old. Technology wasn't ready at the time, but now, almost 50 years later, the Metals Company of Canada, whose CEO visited the White House to lobby for this, is leading the mining industry back into the deep. It's also applied to NOAA to begin mining in international waters that the rest of the world recognizes as being under the legal authority of the UN's International Seabed Authority. So lots of potential political clashes there. Over 30 nations have now called for a moratorium on deep sea mining until we better understand the world's largest habitat. The U.S. in the last administration supported this take it slow approach. Deep sea mining was, quote, not ready for prime time, is what Monica Medina, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Oceans, told us in an earlier episode of Rising Tide. But now Trump Secretary of State Marco Rubio has eliminated that position. So it's a fast-moving story. We've talked about it before on Rising Tide. We're certainly going to have to talk about it again. We pledge to keep our listeners informed on what's happening and, more importantly, what they can do, what you can do. Okay, let's get back to something hopeful. The Aquarium Conservation Partnership. Kim, you've been its executive director since 2017. But how did you first connect with the ocean?
My first connection with the ocean was actually through the New England Aquarium in Boston when I was young. I was raised in a small suburb in Massachusetts. And while we got to the beach in the summertime, my mother she was scared of the ocean, to be honest. And so seeing the underwater world for the first time at the aquarium really opened my eyes to all these possibilities. You know, that and watching movies like The Incredible Mr. Limpet, which I don't know if you remember, was from the 60s before I was born, but I just
can't
remember
forget
watching
it.
That.
Live
yeah,
action
with Don Knotts
animation.
Turning into a fish. And of course, you know, my youth obsession with mermaids and that was well before mermaids were of all the rage. So yeah, I don't know where my fascination came from besides just, you know, seeing it for the first time at the aquarium and whenever I got out to the ocean.
Yeah, I think those aquarium visits for many children are extremely memorable. I grew up in New York and worked at the New York Aquarium when I was in high school. And that changed my life. That put me on this path, this ocean path. So we'd love to hear more about how you're working with these aquariums. Aquariums have changed a lot over the last, many decades. Tell us a little bit more about what the partnership is doing.
So the partnership was formed in 2016 by Monterey Bay Aquarium, Shedd Aquarium in Chicago, and the National Aquarium in Baltimore to really test the idea of aquariums coming together to work collectively on conservation priorities and policies, especially because at that time, not many aquariums were doing policy work. Monterey Bay Aquarium was at the forefront of that and recognizing the role of aquariums in policy. And so wanted to share what they've done along with, you know, other big aquariums like National and Shedd. And so they started a pilot project in 2016. It was meant to be a two-year pilot project. And the CEOs from those aquariums, Julie Packard and John Racanelli, invited other CEOs across AZA institutions, that's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, to really come together and say that they wanted to work collectively. And so they came together, and the first thing they did was make a commitment to eliminate single-use plastic straws, bags, and bottles from their institutions, and also to develop a public-facing campaign, increasing the awareness of the impacts of plastic pollution, which at the time in 2016 wasn't in everyone's everyday conversation.
So the Monterey Bay Aquarium is also already well known for its Sustainable Seafood Watch. And that had been a major campaign to, you know, with the red, yellow, and green signage of what's safe to eat, what puts fisheries at risk and the environment. And plastic, because it's so ubiquitous, this was a great opening gambit to begin the partnership on. And how did it go? How widespread did plastic awareness get in the aquariums?
So it proved to be a really good test case for aquariums, recognizing that they could do something on site when they're talking about plastic reduction to their audiences by actually walking the talk and making these changes within their own institutions. They could use that voice and share lessons learned with the aquariums and showing, or with their audiences, and showing that if we can do it, you can do it as well. And then using that to lobby for stricter plastic reduction. So many aquariums at that point were working on state and local ordinances around plastic, especially in California. At the time, there wasn't that much federal legislation, but then, of course, we started to see more activity at the federal level. And so we were able to use the voice of aquariums and our audiences to advocate for stronger reduction in plastic policies. And so the plastic was our first kickoff priority. And the pilot phase, I'm happy to say, evolved into us being a permanent partnership. And we have grown from one conservation priority area, which is plastic, to five now. So ocean justice and environmental justice, reducing sources of plastic pollution, of course, we kept, sustainable seafood and aquaculture, combating climate change, and of course, increasing protections for ecosystems and wildlife.
So that's a lot to cover. Before we get to it, 2016, these three aquariums came together. You came on in 2017. What was your background and how did the aquarium partnership grow from three to 35 aquariums?
Well, I kind of took a meandering path to get to where I am today. And I feel like, you know, landing at the ACP was the perfect role for me. My background is in marine biology. I studied marine biology at University of Miami and then moved to Hawaii, actually. We had a family friend who lived in Hawaii, and my family thought, well, it's surrounded by ocean. You should just probably go out there. I honestly thought I was going to get my PhD, and my passion was cephalopods and studying squid and octopus. And so I met with a professor who did that. And I remember walking away not feeling as inspired as I thought I would when I was applying for a PhD program and passing by the law school on the campus of University of Hawaii. And popped in there and got a brochure in their environmental law program, met with the director, Casey Jarman, at the time, and realized that there's this whole other world to ocean conservation, that there wasn't just that one path through science, which wasn't, I knew ocean was my passion, but I couldn't figure out like where I fit in that. And so I ended up going to law school. I had the amazing opportunity to study with people like Steve Rohde, who ran the Earth Justice Ocean Program forever. He was a visiting professor there. Allison Reeser, who focuses on fisheries law And so I really was able to take that time and focus in on ocean and environmental law, which then led me to working with a coalition out in Hawaii with fishers, local fishers, Native Hawaiians, and environmentalists to really protect our ocean resources in Hawaii. You know, and we were part of getting the what we thought was going to be sanctuary, but of course, the monument out there. And I realized my sweet spot was really bringing together people from different backgrounds, from ocean law, from science, from business, and really kind of that coalition building was my sweet spot. And so went from there, moved here to California with my husband. I met my husband in Hawaii, and now we've been in San Diego for the past 20 years or so. Ran the West Coast Governors Alliance on Ocean Health. I also got my degree, my master's degree through the Center for Marine Biodiversity and Conservation here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. It was its second year. I was working with Nancy Knowlton, Enrique Sala, Jeremy Jackson. So they started that program. And it was just a great interdisciplinary program that I wish existed when I was younger in my schooling. But it opened up the world for me to a lot of people here in San Diego to work on broad scale coalition building and working together, recognizing that we need to work together to solve these really big issues.
A lot of people think the only way to get into ocean conservation and marine science is kind of that scientific path. But there's, you know, the law piece, the policy piece, which are so important in our ocean conservation community. I also did a policy track and was at the University of Miami and realized like bringing people together on that coalition building is so critical. And that's what the Aquarium Partnership is doing. And that's what, you know, we need more than ever right now.
So just to reiterate, because we say follow your passion. So you got out to Hawaii, you looked at it, said octopuses, not so much. Oh, environmental law and regulatory state. Very interesting. Love it.
I do still, you know, octopus and squid are still my favorite animals. But yeah, I mean, I do get really excited about regulations.
So. So when were you, what were you doing when you were offered the partnership position?
Well, I wasn't offered it. I chased it down. It's funny. So when they first started in 2016, they put out a call for consultants. And I saw that. I'm like, that is so perfect for me. And I'm so perfect for it. So I think I stalked, you know, the folks who were making the hiring decisions. And I didn't get it initially. But then they realized that they needed a full-time human in that position and not a consulting firm. And so, you know, I jumped at the chance and went up and interviewed with Amy David in Monterey Bay Aquarium and basically convinced them that I was the right person for this job. So I'm, you know, hope they still think so. I mean, I evolved. I was hired as a coordinator and then evolved the role into an executive director position. We grew from, I think, 12 initial members to over 35 now. And we've really diversified our funding. We are member fee based, but we've really diversified our funding to be not only member-based, but we get funding from private foundations, from federal grants up until now. And then, of course, the Peter Benchley Ocean Awards was our first fundraiser.
Wow. Well, speaking of Peter Benchley Ocean Awards, I think I'm still kind of buzzing from a few weeks ago where we all got together at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. And I think David and I both heard this throughout the evening, was that we really needed that celebration more than ever. And especially folks, I think, in around DC and the East Coast. It was inspiring and it just helped us remember that there's all of this amazing work going on, even when we're kind of being squashed from the top down. So tell us more about how that, you know, how the aquariums got involved and what's the plan moving forward for the Peter Benchley Ocean Awards.
Great. Well, I'm so glad both of you made it out there and enjoyed the night like so many other people did. I would say that the, you know, partnering with aquariums is a natural fit. And first of all, we're so honored that Wendy, Benchley, and David trusted us to partner with them to relaunch the awards. I know this has been a conversation that we started with Wendy at an ocean gala a couple years ago. John Racanelli from National Aquarium introduced me to Wendy. And I know that previously the awards were hosted at a couple different aquariums, which just seemed like the natural venue for something like this. And we said, wouldn't it be cool to be able to have the awards at a different aquarium every year? And so it was a couple years in the making, and we're really thrilled to bring them back annually and to be able to highlight the different role that aquariums play in the ocean conservation space, as well as to showcase the institutions themselves. And I'm really glad that you said, you know, that this brought us joy at a time where we need it, because that's what aquariums really do. So even during these dark times, you know, during the first Trump administration, aquariums can lean into that joy, the fun part of ocean conservation, and, you know, really use that unique voice that we have when talking about ocean conservation, because we have to. We have, you know, a really wide breadth of audiences ranging from geography to political affiliations to ideologies, ages. You know, we reach so many different people with so many different backgrounds that we don't want to overwhelm people with the doom and gloom. And so always taking a positive spin on the ocean and what you can do and what we can do as businesses, as conservation organizations, as research institutions is really our sweet spot and leaning into that.
Do you love the salty characters and ocean champions we have on The Rising Tide? So do we. And we're dedicated to bringing inspiring stories and voices that make waves. But here's the catch. We need your support to keep the tide rolling. A tax-deductible donation at bluefront.org will help keep The Rising Tide on the air and online. If you're ready and able to amplify these salty voices for the sea, dive in with a donation, big or small. Visit bluefront.org and join the movement. And now, back to the show.
How have the aquariums changed over time? Before we get to what the partnership's doing today, aquariums as a whole sort of moved into this realm of, it used to be just sort of fish jails to see odd creatures. Now they're a lot about the oceans.
So aquariums have changed a lot in the last couple decades, first as purely entertainment, then known as educational facilities. And now we're really, through ACP, helping evolve them as true conservation organizations. So not only the research work that they do both in situ and ex situ and the research they do across the world, but also as actors in making true like policy changes. And so that's something that it's been really great to see evolve, especially through ACP, is the policy activities, where many aquariums were a little hesitant at first to put their names on letters of support for something or even push anything out to their visitors, are now recognizing that their visitors and audiences expect them to take action on the things and issues that they care about. And what we have is, you know, of course, people protect what they love. And so not as many people are as lucky as we do to work in ocean conservation and to get to go diving to Catalina and, you know, live a few blocks from the ocean. And so the aquariums are a place where a lot of people, that's the only time they're going to see a fish or a shark in real life. And so really making that connection to what they're seeing and how they can protect and support the animals that they fall in love with the aquariums.
Yes, I think that's the whole protect what you love is critical here, and that's what the aquariums can provide. I think the sustainable seafood piece of things and the education around that, for me, that was a huge part, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, living here in the Bay Area. And that's one thing I feel like a lot of people who are not in the ocean world, they used to pull out their seafood watch card, and that was huge for the aquariums to get involved in that.
I'm not an expert in the Seafood Watch program, but of course it's been around for more than 20 years and has done so much in changing, you know, the face of sustainability of seafood. And because it started at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, they know how to talk to aquarium audiences and had to have aquariums be able to highlight the sustainable choices that you make and how it impacts the ocean. And so, you know, when we were at National Aquarium, they've got a kiosk there with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch program, has a kiosk there. And there are actually a lot of other seafood programs that some aquariums do on their own, which they're highlighting the local species and the local fishing methods. And so that's a really robust program that we, you know, we wanted to take the successes of that and apply it to ACP. And now we're actually taking it a step further, where we're piloting a business commitment right now across our institutions, where we're looking at the seafood that we're feeding the animals in our care. So the animals in our care get a lot of forage fish species, which aren't necessarily rated because they aren't eaten in at least the Western world, right? So we don't know if they're rated green or yellow or red. And so
we're starting to... And forage fish are the small fish that the big fish eat.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the fish that the animals like to eat, not only in our institutions, but in the real world. So we're looking at all the different fish and other species that our animals are eating across our institutions and looking at what is rated unsustainable and how can we make shifts, leveraging our market to buy more sustainable, either buy more sustainable seafood or actually to create some more sustainable fisheries for the species that we feed to the animals.
I love it. So you're not only feeding sustainable fish to your guests, but also to your residents.
Right. It's really about walking the talk with the Aquarium Conservation Partnership. So anytime that we're asking our audiences to take action on something, whether it's a policy, whether it's a choice they make at home, we want to make sure that our institutions are really doing the same and not greenwashing or anything. So in addition to that and our initial plastic commitment, all of our members have made commitments to become net zero through different pathways of their own, of course. So we don't have one big goal where all of our members are going to be net zero by a certain time, but we provide the resources and support for them to make their own net zero goals and to support them.
Net zero, we're now talking about climate change.
We're talking about climate change.
Carbon dioxide. So how is that going? That's a third of your five programs. So all the aquariums want to become non-emitters of carbon pollution by when and how?
So each institution has made their own goal because they all operate, you know, in different areas and have different access to clean energy. But what we have done is we provide the support through partners like the Veritas Group, where we do greenhouse gas inventories for everyone first to see where we all are, and then to pull together basically a brain trust of solutions across all of our institutions to see, you know, where institutions can decrease their emissions. As you know, aquariums are very high energy intensity. We're more akin to a hospital than anything because we have life support services and systems to keep our animals alive. We have tons of water, which is highly energy intensive. So we have really unique factors that we have to take into consideration.
Yeah, you're moving water, you're heating water, you're cooling mm-hmm. water. It's very energy intensive.
So the Aquarium Conservation Partnership, it's addressing plastics, it's addressing sustainable seafood, climate change in terms of reducing aquariums' use of dirty energy, shifting to a transition into clean. And you have two other projects, you were saying.
Well, two other conservation goals. And so how we approach each of our conservation goal is through walking the talk at our own institutions. So that's through business commitments. So for our environmental justice and ocean justice goal, we've developed a commitment for race equity culture within our own institutions. And so providing support for all the people who work at our institutions and all the people who come visit, that we are developing a race equity culture. And that's either through institutional policy action and advocacy, and also engaging our audiences to take action. And then, of course, through inspiring our over 40 million in-person visitors a year and hundreds of millions of people online to take action. And so that's where communications is such a huge part of what we do. So developing public campaigns, developing sign-on petitions, doing on-site exhibits, well, not exhibits, but signage. So right now we have a grant with the NOAA Marine Debris Program to install 7 different exhibits and signage at our institutions to talk about plastic pollution and the impact on the local waterways and local environments there. So we do a lot.
Okay. And the fifth is, so if I got it right, it's dealing with plastic pollution, sustainable seafood and aquaculture, the climate, and both within the aquariums and in the world as a whole to make the transition to clean energy. Equity, which is really to have the community reflect all of America, different racial and ethnic mixes.
And as well as to make sure that people are being invited to the decision-making table who are not normally invited.
Who've been excluded in the past. And the fifth is?
Protecting ecosystems and wildlife. So this is things mostly, well, obviously our aquarium, that's what they do. They protect all the wildlife through rescue rehab programs and the ecosystem, so marine protected areas that many of our institutions are involved with locally, as well as nationally and globally. But it's really what ACP does is we do a lot around the policy in this space. So protecting, you know, the Endangered Species Act. We just had a small Endangered Species Act, a campaign that we pushed out because there was a regulation that they're trying to rescind the definition of harm for the endangered species. And so we had a big push where we did a public comment letter that was with all of our institutions, as well as pushing out to our audiences sign-on letters as well. So our audiences can use their voice to say that they want to protect a strong and uphold a strong endangered species.
And again, this definition of harm, they're now saying that unless you actually shoot the bald eagle or the manatee, that if you just destroy their habitat, that's okay. That's their redefinition of harm. So obviously crazy. So how does the partnership grow? You talk about 40 million visitors. I've heard there are 80 million visitors to aquariums in the nation.
So you've grown. I think they're far more than that. So we've grown slowly, intentionally, to make sure that we are being able to do what we want to do and also meet the needs of our members. So when we first started, our membership was only open to AZA nonprofit institutions. Since then, we have expanded.
And I'm sorry, AZA is the American Zoo and Aquarium.
Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And so they're the highest standard of accreditation for zoos and aquariums. So ensuring that our members have, you know, the top-notch animal care and facilities. We are looking at different ways to expand that, especially for international partners. And so there's so many amazing facilities across the world that we could work with. So we are always looking at how we can grow intentionally. We just opened up to for-profit institutions. We have a special category for that, including our first corporate membership category. And so the SSA Group, who is a big vendor in the space, they provide dining and retail operations for not only aquariums, but zoos and cultural institutions across the world. They're our first corporate member because they're really sustainability-minded and focused and want to do the right thing as well. And then they can produce amazing events such as the Peter Benchley Ocean Award. All the food that we had was from SSA Group. So yeah, there are other ways to be involved, not only as a member, but as a supporter. And now, you know, with us doing the Peter Benchley Ocean Awards, there's so many different ways to engage. So our website's aquariumconservation.org.
And I just want to thank Kim McIntyre so much for being with us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. This has been an amazing episode to talk about how aquariums are inspiring all of us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review or share it with your friends and other ocean lovers. Follow us on Instagram and visit bluefront.org for more updates and additional resources. Rising Tide is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by David Helvark and me, Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, Kelly Bates, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay hopeful and stay salty.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier. Tear, tear. Off in the salty ocean, off to the blue frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky! There you are, good boy, Sparky!